It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Charles Payne.
I'm Kat Timpf.
I'm Stuart Varney, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. I'm Dave Anthony. Former President Trump may soon be indicted in New York City by a progressive district attorney who claims it's not political.
If this was anyone other than Donald Trump, Bragg would not be bringing this case.
I'm Lisa Brady. As Russia and China put up a united front, U.S. armed forces try to put up better numbers.
2023 is the crunch year for military recruiting, for sure.
And I'm Ian Pryor. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
To former President Trump, it's the same old, same old.
Just a continuation of the most disgusting witch hunt in the history of our country.
Posting on Truth Social about an investigation in New York City into something that happened before he was elected.
It's an absolute disgrace what's going on.
But this time, he appears closer than ever to becoming the first president, current or former, to be criminally charged. Those are anti-Trump protesters. Chanting indict, indict, and no one is above the law. Outside the office of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, a progressive Democrat who has a grand jury probing the hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels prior to the 2016 presidential election as a possible campaign finance violation, keeping her quiet about her claims of a past affair. Trump lawyer Alina Haba says,
"This is a politicization of our justice system, and I think it's a frightening time for our country, frankly. If Michael Cohen is a key witness, as we're hearing."
Bragg's office claims this is not politics. Cohen is the former Trump lawyer, or fixer as he's been called, who orchestrated that hush money payment, then later went to prison for tax evasion and campaign finance law violations. His former advisor, a Trump ally, Robert Costello, testified to that same grand jury to contradict Cohen and then told Fox,
"I wouldn't touch a witness like Michael Cohen for any amount of money. You simply cannot rely upon this guy."
Calling Cohen a liar on a revenge tour. But as soon as today, or maybe next week, an indictment may be coming.
You know, this idea that President Trump would be arrested, which actually is a notion that he promoted, is really not accurate.
Andrew McCarthy is a former federal prosecutor, now a Fox News contributor.
Because we're talking about a nonviolent crime, and there's good reason to wonder whether it's a crime at all, but let's assume for argument's sake that it is. It's certainly nonviolent. So I anticipate what would happen if an indictment is returned by the grand jury is that an arrangement will be made with former President Trump to come to Manhattan and surrender. Basically, he won't be handcuffed on the street. They'll make an arrangement where he'll go to the courthouse. The New York City police will have people there who can process him, which means he would be fingerprinted and photographed like anybody else who comes into the system. He'll be presented before a judge. He might enter a plea at the first proceeding. It's typical to enter a not guilty plea after you've been indicted. And then the case, Dave, will get assigned to a trial judge who will set a schedule for pretrial motions and we'll be off to the races.
The charge in this case, what would it be? If there is an indictment, what is the charge?
So we hear that the main part of this case, the gravamen of the case, as they say in the law, is the Stormy Daniels hush money agreement. And in a nutshell, they paid her $130,000 to keep quiet about an affair she claims to have had with Donald Trump in around 2006, 2007. He denies it. She says it happened. It really doesn't matter whether it happened or not. In terms of what the charge is likely to be, which is the falsification of business records.
The payment itself was from then Trump associate lawyer Michael Cohen, $130,000 for the nondisclosure agreement. So quiets her keeps her quiet before the 2016 presidential election. Right. Then Michael Cohen gets paid back for the money that he paid. And that's where we are, right? That it's all about how that repayment was classified, right?
Or, yeah, that's exactly right. It's as succinctly as I can put it, this was a reimbursement of a debt that was incurred in October of 2016. And in their books, the Trump Organization and Donald Trump, who are kind of conflated for these purposes, they booked it as if they were paying Cohen legal fees throughout 2017. So it's made in the books to look like it's a payment of legal fees over 12 months, but it's in fact reimbursement for the debt incurred. The reason that this becomes relevant is because what we've just described, this falsification of business records, is a misdemeanor under New York law. The only way it becomes a felony is if the prosecutor can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to conceal the commission of another crime in falsifying the business records. So the question is, what other crime could conceivably have been being covered up?
And would that be the campaign contribution that he says was unreported?
Yeah, that's what you're pointing out is the crime that most of the educated speculation figures that Bragg is going to say Trump was concealing. He's got big problems trying to do that. First, the campaign finance laws are federal. When the New York statute about falsifying business records, when it talks about concealing another crime, that's a quote from the statute, another crime, they're obviously talking about a New York crime. And the campaign finance laws in a presidential election are the federal laws. So he shouldn't be able to vindicate federal law in a state prosecution. He doesn't have jurisdiction to do that. And it's important to point out, Dave, that most campaign finance violations, they're typically handled by allowing the candidate or the campaign to pay a fine to the election authorities. So this is not something that's typically handled as a felony prosecution. I just don't see how that could be the other crime that he's talking about.
Okay. Now, obviously, Republicans are accusing this Democratic district attorney in Manhattan, Alvin Bragg, of being political. I want you to hear from Jim Jordan. He chairs the House Judiciary Committee. He and other GOP committee chairs have written to Bragg. They want him to testify about what he's doing in New York. And this is Jordan on Fox.
Mr. Bragg himself didn't want to bring the case, but then he got pressured, I think, from the left. And I would say this, the one thing that has changed, the one thing that I think has changed his mind is President Trump announced he was going to run for president again.
And the former president wants Bragg brought up on some sort of a charge of interfering with an upcoming presidential election. Now, Bragg's office says we will not be intimidated by attempts to undermine the justice process and the accusations are baseless. So what's your reply to the politics that are surrounding the legal issues?
Well, a lot of this rhetoric is silly. You know, if we want to be serious, there's no question that what Bragg is doing here is a naked partisan exercise. He's an elected progressive Democrat. Going after Donald Trump, as we've seen, is good politics in big cities, even if it's atrocious law enforcement.
But Andy, on the other side of that, Bragg defenders say that when he took office, he declined to move forward on an investigation into Trump business practices, which led some prosecutors who were leading the case to resign from his office. So Bragg defenders are saying, look, he has credibility because he didn't go after Trump in that other case. So why is it politics now?
This is that case. This is the case that he walked away from. You know, what the Democrats and the people in the DA's office were hoping was that when Bragg's predecessor, Cyrus Vance, went to the Supreme Court twice to get Trump's financial records, they were hoping that was going to be the mother lode of a big financial fraud prosecution. They didn't have enough evidence for a criminal prosecution, which is why they didn't bring the case. Tish James, who was the state attorney general ended up trying to charge that as a big civil case. We'll have to see how that all works out. But they did it as a civil case because that's a lower burden of proof. But the fact is, the very case that we're talking about, Bragg dropped a year ago and now is bringing back, I think, because number one, the adulation that that Tish James got for filing the big civil suit against Trump. And number two, because one of the prosecutors who left the office, Mark Pomerantz, ended up writing a book that is now like bedtime reading for all progressives called, I think, The People Against Donald Trump. So basically, they've ratcheted up, as progressives do, the political pressure on Bragg, who is one of them. And the one thing we can say conclusively is that if this was anyone other than Donald Trump, Bragg would not be bringing this case. And what Bragg has been notorious for in his tenure is actually taking serious felony offenses and degrading them to misdemeanors or entirely dismissing them when you're talking about actual hardened criminals. Here, he's taking stale nonsense, which at best is a misdemeanor, and trying to hyperbolize it into a felony, clearly for political reasons.
Of course, this is just one of many Trump investigations. The Justice Department is probing all the classified documents found at his Florida resort and looking into his post-2020 election conduct leading up to the January 6th Capitol riot. And then there's the Georgia investigation into Trump's attempts to overturn the election results in that state. So there could be other criminal charges coming.
I think that, you know, the fact that the first prosecutor crosses the Rubicon kind of makes it easier for other prosecutors who may have been worried about the fraud politics of charging Trump. This at least makes it a little bit easier for them to go forward. So we've had in the Fulton County, Georgia case, we had the forewoman of the grand jury come out and do basically a press tour a few weeks ago after that grand jury filed its investigative report. And she said that they recommended to the district attorney that many people be charged. And she powerfully suggested that President or former President Trump was at the top of the list. Concurrently, we see that Jack Smith, who was the Biden Justice Department appointed special counsel, who's looking at both the Mar-a-Lago documents case and January 6th, has stepped up his activity. And he's obviously not doing that idly. So those are very serious investigations, and they could well end up in indictments.
Could be a very interesting 2024 campaign with all this hanging over his head, and he remains the front runner for the Republicans.
Yeah, well, you know, the Constitution says the qualifications for president are that you have to be 35 and a natural born citizen who's lived in the United States for 14 years. Ain't nothing else. So if they want to, you know, the American people want to elect somebody who's under investigation or someone who's convicted of a crime or someone who's doing time at Leavenworth, they can do it. Nothing in the Constitution says they can't, but it's strange times.
Andy McCarthy, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York and a Fox News contributor. Always good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Ian Pryor with your Fox News commentary. Coming up.
China and Russia say they've never been closer. Presidents Xi and Putin, after 2 days of meetings in Moscow, pledging to deepen cooperation and expand economic ties, calling each other dear friends.
We're not going to get all hot and bothered about the use of friends. What we've seen is these are two countries that are growing closer together, that see in each other useful purposes.
But National Security Council spokesman John Kirby calls it a marriage of convenience rather than a true alliance. And he rejects Russia's continued claims that its invasion of Ukraine is defensive for its own security and that the West is prolonging the conflict, supplying weapons to Ukraine.
Mr. Putin could stop bombing hospitals. could stop bombing schools. He could stop launching Iranian drones into civilian infrastructure. He could stop the forcible deportation of young kids, thousands of them, putting them in filtration camps.
A joint statement from China and Russia calls for observing the principles and purposes of the UN Charter and respecting international law. Kirby says what they really want is for the world to play by their rules instead. A deepening relationship between two foreign adversaries at a time of daunting statistics for the U.S. military. The Senate Armed Services Committee holding a hearing today on recruitment challenges. One Defense Department study says 80% of Americans ages 17 to 24 are unfit for military service. And the number interested in serving has been shrinking.
Military recruiting, it's the perfect storm.
Rebecca Grant is a national security analyst and founder of IRIS Independent Research.
There's high employment in the civilian economy. Remember, the recruiters have not been out in the high schools as much over the past 2 years. That's really hurting them. And then there's some bigger factors. Only about 9% of young Americans say they would consider military service. On top of that, some issues passing physical fitness tests and the other standard military test batteries. And it adds up to a really big problem. It's been brewing for quite a while, but it got a lot worse last year.
I want to unpack some of that, starting with perceptions of the military, if you will. There was a study last year that found only 55% of Gen Zers have some or a lot of trust in the military, compared to 86% of baby boomers. And then you add to that concerns that military officials have raised, that they have said may be a factor, including concern among younger Americans about things like sexual harassment in the military, for instance, or PTSD. How can the military work to counteract some of these things? Is that part of what's going on?
Yes. And remember, world events can really drive perceptions of the military, so that after the horrific events of 9/11, there was a big surge in recruiting. If Gen Z doesn't feel directly threatened by Russia or China or Iran or even the southern border, then you've got an issue in their willingness to serve. There's been a lot of focus by the military on preventing and diminishing sexual harassment. When that makes the headlines, you know, the reality is that the military is working to improve there, but I can see where that sometimes gets misunderstood. And then add in that we've had a volunteer force now for many, many decades. And that means that there are some families out there that just don't have anybody in the military, no experience of a brother or a sister or an aunt or a granddad in the service, and that adds up to that lower propensity to serve. But that's what recruiters in the military, it's their job to turn that around and show young Americans the opportunities that the services can provide them.
And as you mentioned, they've not been able to be at high schools, or at least they weren't, you know, at the height of the pandemic. So COVID definitely plays a role in terms of the outreach ability in person. How much have the qualifications to serve evolved over time? Is it more difficult now to enlist?
On the contrary, the services always fluctuate those standards. The Army has set in place a program to help recruits even before they get to boot camp. So they do more running and exercises so they're able to meet the minimum standards. And very interesting, the Navy actually just raised the age for enlisting from 38 all the way up to 41 to try to expand that pool. So the services, they need fit individuals because they have to deploy. But they also really want to meet Americans part of the way. If they're willing to serve, they will help you get through those fitness requirements. It has been a problem in the overall population as we see more rates of obesity among the young and other problems that does affect that pool. But the military services really want to try to get in there and help you. If you want to serve, they don't want to let the physical part stand in your way.
What about lowering standards for enlistment? Is that something that's been talked about? Would it be too dangerous? Or, you know, are there common sense changes that they try to make over time to help with that?
It's just like any recruiting that you do, whether it's for college admissions or the military, you move that bar a little bit. You're always going to have your minimum standards met, but you move it a little bit on test scores or physical fitness if you need to take a bigger group in. And all the services say that they have actually dropped that a little bit. And they're doing some interesting things like being more lenient on tattoos, a little more lenient about enlisted personnel who are single and have a child coming in. So they have some ability to fluctuate the standards in order to recruit a bigger group.
Are all of the branches struggling or some faring better than others?
The Space Force is the huge exception. It's the sixth branch, the newest and smallest service, under 10,000 people, but they are not struggling. The Space Force is turning away people. It is so popular, right up from the enlistees coming out of high school to mid-career professionals that are going into the officer corps. The Space Force is so popular, it is actually turning recruits away.
How does our military compare to China and Russia at this point? They've increasingly made themselves, you know, U.S. adversaries on the world stage. We've heard about China building up its navy. Should the U.S. be concerned or more concerned about how those countries are building their militaries?
Well, on personnel, there is just no comparison. U.S. military personnel are far superior in quality and in training to anything that Russia and China has. On the equipment and the hardware, though, hey, that's another story. China really has built up its number of ships and aircraft. They have a big army, not as big as it used to be, but still very large. And we know that China and Russia have been acting much more aggressively. They're also allies now, military allies. And that military alliance between China and Russia is very, very disturbing. And it means that our U.S. military, along with our allies, really has to be at the peak of readiness. And long term, that's why the military has to resolve this recruiting problem so we can continue to have the quality, best in the world military members in the U.S.
In the meantime, we keep sending a lot of equipment to Ukraine. The Pentagon's planning to speed up delivery of tanks to Ukraine now by sending an older version of the Abrams. Are they just as good in terms of helping to meet Ukraine's needs?
I'm glad that the Abrams tanks are going over there. Look, we have about 8,000 Abrams in the inventory in various states of readiness, and it is no problem to send 31. It's not the latest variant. It's the M1A1, not the M1A2. But believe me, these 31 Abrams tanks going to Ukraine are highly capable, and they need to get there right away. So that's a good move.
So when you talk about several dozen tanks compared to the thousands that we have, it sounds like we're okay when it comes to tanks. What about the rest of our stockpiles, though? The administration just announced another drawdown. Do we have enough of everything to keep doing this for Ukraine?
We need to keep doing this for Ukraine, and it's no secret that there are parts of our munitions, industrial base especially, that need to be speeded up. You know, we're not depleting U.S. reserves to a dangerous level, but there are areas in various types of missiles and ammunition where we need to have the Pentagon take the lead with Congress and go and get some advanced long lead funding for our industry to top that back up. But hey, you know, Ukraine is getting to, I think, a pretty critical situation right now. And we do at the moment, along with our allies and the 54 countries that are helping out, we do have enough to keep sending it. Remember, really, this was what we invested in these munitions for, was to protect democracy and beat back Russia if we had to. So I'm glad the Ukrainians are doing that.
In addition to the inherent, you know, potential danger of serving, of defending the country, how much of an impact can other health concerns have? And I ask that because of the recent Pentagon study finding higher risks of certain kinds of cancer in military aviation, including for ground crews. Has that been a concern for a long time?
Congress authorized this study, and they looked at a million people who had served in air crews or the ground crews that support the aviators, and found higher incidence of cancers in a few specific areas, melanoma, thyroid cancer, and a couple of others. I think this concern was anecdotal, and the study showed that it's epidemiological. It's really a valid concern. What will happen now in phase two is Congress has asked the military to find out why these rates of cancer are higher among these crews and to look at the work environment and potential hazards. It'll take them some time to uncover that. Interesting, of course, that overall the aviators and the ground crew are a very healthy bunch. Their overall cancer rates are lower than the typical population, but they're higher in these specific areas. And on recruiting, usually Air Force, Navy, aviation recruiting is actually one of the easiest of the billets to fill.
Would you say the outlook is getting better or worse right now in terms of this recruiting issue? Is the military doing enough to try to turn a corner on it?
Well, 2023 is really going to be the test case. The problem is biggest for the Army. They missed by 15,000 recruits last year. They want to actually bring in 65,000 this year. They're going to have to work very, very hard to do that. If they miss this year's goal, they've got a real problem. Navy and Air Force, they made their requirements, but just barely. They also know they have to start earlier and do better. And I think getting the recruiters out into the schools and into the community more, things that they couldn't do during COVID, hopefully will make the difference. But 2023 is the crunch year for military recruiting for sure.
Rebecca Grant, National Security Analyst, founder of Iris Independent Research. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. Do you think there could be a zombie apocalypse one day? If you do, you're one of 10 Americans that feel that way, according to a new survey. But where you live could impact the likelihood of survival. The success of The Last of Us on HBO led insurance marketplace Insurance to ask more than 1,000 Americans about zombies and what they think they should do if there were to be a zombie apocalypse. They analyzed more than 1,000 Google searches to determine where each state lands on the zombie apocalypse preparedness. According to the survey, Wyoming is the readiest state to take on The Walking Dead. The organization said states that aren't heavily populated and have access to a lot of open space are the best because you can live off the land, stockpile weapons, and avoid other people. Alaska is your next best bet, followed by Vermont, North Dakota, and South Dakota. The worst state? The Golden State. California landing in 50th place for where to spend the end of the world, topped by Texas, Florida, New York, Pennsylvania at the bottom of the list. As for the weapons to use when fighting off zombies, participants apparently thought about that already, too. The number one weapon they chose to defend themselves was a shotgun, followed by a handgun, baseball bat, machete, crossbow, sword, axe, knife, grenade, and katana. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
New from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for season 3 of my limited time podcast, Everything Will Be Okay, based on my best-selling book of the same name. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Ian Pryor. What's on your mind?
This week, the Parents' Bill of Rights, HB 5, will be debated on the floor of the House of Representatives. This bill will help provide greater transparency in public schools, give parents statutory rights alongside their constitutional right to direct the upbringing of their children, and pressure our public education system to focus on academics instead of social indoctrination. Having helped lead the fight in Loudoun County, Virginia, it is a testament to the hard work of parents that House Republicans have made this a priority in the new Congress. This week, I release a new book, Parents of the World Unite, How to Save Our Schools from the Left's Radical Agenda, in which I document the successes the parents in Loudoun County had in shining the spotlight of accountability on America's most notorious public school administration and school board. The story is told through 12 strategic rules that helped guide our actions over the past 2 years, but can also be used to maximum effect by parents and parent groups throughout the country. These are those rules. Every neighborhood is a battlefield. Pay attention to what happens on your street and in your community. The infection of cancel culture and wokeism is not limited to the federal government, corporate boardrooms, professional sports, or Hollywood, but has arrived next door. Activate, investigate, communicate. Every parent can be a private investigator into the moral corruption of the schools that they pay for and send their children to. With key tools like the Freedom of Information Act, the Protection of People Rights Amendment, and targeted media outreach, anyone can start to shine the spotlight of accountability on their school district. Always flip the script. With a combination of fearlessness and humorous mockery, parents can punch through the far left's most potent psychological tool, fear of cancel culture, and bring the fight to the bullies. Identify the bad guys and take it to them. Every conflict by its nature needs a good versus evil framework. It is therefore important to find the right bad guys to fight. Turn your fight into must-see TV. The greatest generals in history always knew that there must be an element of showmanship to the battle. Do not get stuck in the mud. Always be in motion. The opposition, however clumsily, will start to fight back and try to engage you on their terms. Do not fall into the trap. When they zig, you must zag and keep moving forward to your goal. When they mobilize, go guerrilla. When you're going up against the status quo, they will find a way to mobilize their political power and legacy media. That's inevitable. What's not inevitable is how you respond. When they finally confront you in the air, morph into a guerrilla operation that maneuvers on the ground. Do not stop at the wall. A battle will have ebbs and flows, and you will find yourself hitting a wall. External and internal dynamics will make it challenging to get past that wall into the green fields on the other side. You gotta believe. Be flexible and open to ideas, but never take your eyes off the North Star, and never forget why you joined the fight in the first place. Don't let them off the ropes. Eventually, your strategies and tactics, if well executed, will bring you to a moment when your opponent is on the ropes. They've made crucial mistakes to be in that situation. When this happens, it's not time to back off. Go for the knockout. Don't be overly reliant on past success. The greater the success, the greater the dangers that follow. Complacency will often set in, as will the tendency to overly rely on the strategies and tactics that brought victory. Eventually, your opponents will adapt and exploit. Play the endgame. Always know your endgame. What started as your primary goal may have become subsumed into something much greater than you could have imagined. When it comes time to shift to that greater purpose, let your opponents distract themselves with what they think while you silently redeploy your efforts to the final victory. As you put on your armor to go fight for your children's present and future, remember these rules and let them serve as a guide in how you design your own approach. But do not limit yourself to only these rules. Think through successes of the past in history, film, literature, business, politics, and sports, and shape your own rules, stick to them, and pass them on to others. That is how we will win this fight together. This is Ian Pryor.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast, bringing you closer to the story than you ever thought possible. Subscribe at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. These are the stories that keep you up at night.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform, and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.